Now, time for the well-read read. Today's well-read read draws on two works, and what's fascinating about them is that they use the same historical material, the same novels, and the novels about plagues, in fact, and come to very, very different conclusions. The question is why? How could they use the same literature and interpret them so differently? We're going to start with a piece by Orhan Pamuk, a Turkish writer. Pamuk has been imprisoned, he's been exiled, he also has won the Nobel Prize. This is a piece that the New York Times printed in translation called What the Great Pandemic Novels Teach Us by Orhan Pamuk. For the past 4 years, I have been writing a historical novel set in 1901, during what is known as the Third Plague Pandemic, an outbreak of bubonic plague that killed millions of people in Asia, but not very many in Europe. Over the past 2 months, friends and family, editors and journalists who know the subject of that novel, Nights of Plague, have been asking me a barrage of questions about pandemics. They are most curious about similarities between the current coronavirus pandemic and the historical outbreaks of plague and cholera. There is an overabundance of similarities. Throughout human and literary history, what makes pandemics alike is not mere commonality of germs and viruses, but that our initial responses were always the same. The initial response to the outbreak of a pandemic has always been denial. National and local governments have always been late to respond and have distorted facts and manipulated figures to deny the existence of the outbreak. In the early pages of A Journal of the Plague Year, the single most illuminating work of literature ever written on contagion and human behavior, Daniel Defoe reports that in 1664, local authorities in some neighborhoods of London tried to make the number of plague deaths appear lower than it was by registering other invented diseases as the recorded cause of death. Humanity's other universal and seemingly unprompted response to pandemics has always been to create rumors and spread false information. The most common rumors during outbreaks of plague were about who had brought the disease in and where it had come from. Around mid-March, as panic and fear began to spread through Turkey, the manager of my bank in my neighborhood in Istanbul told me with a knowing air that this thing was China's economic retort to the United States and the rest of the world. Like evil itself, plague was always portrayed as something that had come from outside. It had struck elsewhere before, and not enough had been done to contain it. In his account of the spread of plague in Athens, Thucydides began by noting that the outbreak had started far away in Ethiopia and Egypt. Disease is foreign. It comes from outside. It is brought in with malicious intent. Rumors about the supposed identity of its original carriers are always the most pervasive and popular. The history and literature of plagues shows us that the intensity of the suffering, of the fear of death, of the metaphysical dread, and of the sense of the uncanny experienced by the stricken populace will also determine the depth of their anger and political discontent. The terror we are feeling, however, excludes imagination and individuality, and it reveals how unexpectedly similar our fragile lives and shared humanity really are. Fear, like the thought of dying, makes us feel alone, but the recognition that we are all experiencing a similar anguish draws us out of our loneliness. The knowledge that the whole of humanity, from Thailand to New York, shares our anxieties about how and where to use a face mask, the safest way to deal with the food we have bought from the grocer, and whether to quarantine and self-quarantine, is a constant reminder that we are not alone. It begets a sense of solidarity. We are no longer mortified by our fear. We discover a humility in it that encourages mutual understanding. Eventually, I realize that fear elicits two distinct responses in me, and perhaps in all of us. Sometimes it causes me to withdraw into myself, towards solitude and silence, but other times it teaches me to be humble and to practice solidarity. These have been extracts from the Orhan Pamuk piece. He then goes on to talk about the cultural and historical factors that lead to stereotypes about Muslim and Asian fatalism and what he calls the preconceived notion that plagues and other epidemics always come from the darkest recesses of the East. He concludes his essay, "For a better world to emerge after this pandemic, we must embrace and nourish the feelings of humility and solidarity engendered by the current moment." Now, David Brooks, a columnist for the New York Times, has read the same literature that Pamuk has. He too has read Defoe, The Journal of the Plague Year, and he's read Dostoevsky, and he's read Camus, The Plague, and he's read the Decameron, some of the same sources that Pamuk relies on. I didn't read everything that Pamuk wrote, but for David Brooks, they lead to quite different lessons. As you can tell from the title of his New York Times piece, "Pandemics Kill Compassion." So here are just a couple of paragraphs. I don't want to read his entire essay, but I do want to then reflect on why he draws different lessons from the same kind of background literature. Here are two of his paragraphs. "This explains one of the puzzling features of the 1918 pandemic." He's talking about the so-called Spanish flu, which, as many of our listeners know, originated not in Spain, but in Kansas. Back to David Brooks. "When it was over, people didn't talk about it. There were very few books or plays written about it. Roughly 675,000 Americans lost their lives to the flu, compared with 53,000 in battle in World War I. And yet it left almost no conscious cultural mark. Perhaps it's because people didn't like who they had become. It was a shameful memory, and therefore suppressed." In her 1976 dissertation, A Cruel Wind, Dorothy Ann Pettit argues that the 1918 flu pandemic contributed to a kind of spiritual torpor afterward. People emerged from it physically and spiritually fatigued. "The flu," Pettit writes, "had a sobering and disillusioning effect on the national spirit." Without much hope, Brooks concludes, "It wouldn't be a bad idea to take steps to fight the moral disease that accompanies the physical one." So much for David Brooks. So what do we take away from him? First, coming out of 1918, there's spiritual torpor, spiritual fatigue, a sobering effect on the national spirit, moral disease. Well, that doesn't correspond to the 1919 that I know. To begin with, we've got the Seattle General Strike, the glorious days when workers in Seattle took over and ran the city to perfection, much better than it had been run before or since. We've got a vast year of strikes, of labor activism, one of the greatest in American history. The Boston police even go on strike, a justifiable strike, because their wages hadn't been raised since, as I remember, since around the Civil War. Hundreds of thousands of steelworkers are on strike. It's a year of major activism. And one of the responses, of course, is the Palmer raids and the vast repressive apparatus of the government mobilized. None of this is torpor or fatigue. So how do we account for, again, Brooks coming out with such different conclusions from what we got with Orhan Pamuk? My quick response would be gloom in, gloom out. If your premise is that people are not capable of much compassion or solidarity or communality, that we humans are mainly individuals looking out for ourselves, and that's all that can be expected of us, and that I think does characterize the premises that Brooks promotes regularly in his columns, then the lessons you draw are about the moral disease accompanying the physical. If, on the other hand, you see the possibility of a better world emerging along with Orhan Pamuk, then this now also represents an opportunity. Let's take advantage of it. This has been Norm Diamond with The Well-Read Red.
For the coming.